everybody. This is your host, Dr. Diana Wiley. The program is Love, Lust, and Laughter. We're going to take a little bit of a departure today, but Dr. Lori Buckley is with me again. I am so happy about that, Lori. Hello, Lori. Lori, can you hear me? Well, she'll be on in a minute. I'll talk about her book, 21 Decisions for Great Sex and a Happy Relationship, which can be purchased on Amazon. And Dr. I narrated with Dr. Lori, we co-narrated Great Sex for a Lifetime, Volumes 1 and 2, available on bettersex.com. I'll write that up in the review. So for this edition of Love, Lust, and Laughter, we're not going to be talking about sex. And that's unusual for us. Lori, are you there yet? Not yet. Okay. It's unusual for us not to be talking about sex, but instead we're going to talk about loss, the ending of a relationship, whether this is through death, divorce, or the ending of a committed romantic partnership. Okay, great. Hello, Lori. Welcome to the program again, my friend.
Oh, can you hear
there
me
you
now?
Are. Hi, hello, Lori.
What's going on? We got lost.
Okay.
I'm here.
Hey, great. Well, I gave the introduction and mentioned that about your book and that we were co-narrators for Great Sex for a Lifetime, and that we're not going to be talking about sex for this program. It's unusual for us. We're going to talk about loss. Did you hear me say that? I'm not sure.
No, I'm hearing you now, yeah.
Okay, good. So we're talking about loss, and that would be the ending of a relationship, whether this is through death, divorce, or the ending of a committed romantic partnership. And,
right, or a decision. Sometimes it's just a decision, right?
Yes, say more about that, Lori.
Well, look, I think that relationships, whether they're, you know, good, bad, you know, however we want to describe our relationships, romantic, they could be friendships, they could be familial, you know, sometimes we make a decision, or we don't, somebody makes a decision to end it. And regardless of where that decision comes from, it's still a loss. It's still a very difficult time for most people. And one of the good things about endings, as they might be difficult, and we do need to properly grieve and mourn loss, there is also a chance for new beginnings. So sometimes it's making a decision to do something that might be difficult, but still might be the best choice.
Precisely. And endings of relationships are always difficult. Of course, death is a finality. And divorce is also a death. It's a death of hopes and expectations. And
yes.
So you told me off the air that you are willing to self-disclose. What Lori and I have in common is that we've both lost partners, in my case, a husband to death, and that was some years ago. And you lost your beloved Alan only 6 months ago. How are you doing, Lori?
Yeah, so...
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you could...
It's a hard conversation, but it's an important conversation. And,
yes.
And I did say I was willing to talk about that because I feel that, you know, there's an opportunity for me to help somebody, or maybe more than one person. But even if it's one person, because... You know, like we were saying before, in my case and in your case and many other people's, it's death, and that's not a choice. Exactly. And sometimes it is something that is not a surprise. You know, somebody's ill and we're prepared for it. And for both of us, it was not that. It was a complete surprise and a sudden death by an accident or illness, but something that we weren't prepared for. So
right.
I know that we're not the only ones. Everybody at some point in their lives is going to suffer loss, and probably of somebody who is very, very dear to them, and that is the thing that we're talking about today. Again, not just death, because endings happen in many different ways, mm-hmm. but it certainly is, it's a difficult time. And, you know, there's no right way to grieve. There's no exact formula. You know, there's books and there's the stages of loss. But we know that it's not linear. We all have to grieve in the best way that we know how. And I can't tell people how to grieve, but what I can, you know, talk about is my journey and how, you know, how it's been for me. And perhaps there's, again, somebody or some people that we can help by talking about this.
Absolutely. Your words to me and to Brian, and we did travel from Seattle to Los Angeles for Alan's very moving memorial service. And you said to me, cherish every moment. And I, as I wrote you, I choked with sadness and tears came to my eyes. And the reaction was kind of mixed up with your grief and remembrances of my late husband, Charlie. And so it is complex. For me, it's quite a few years since Charlie died. For you, Alan only died 6 months ago. So you're in a real raw stage of grief. Can you talk just a little bit about that? I know it's hard, but I like your attitude, Lori, that talking about it may help people, and that's what I discovered when I
and me
have,
too.
Yeah,
yeah,
yes. When I was in Hawaii after Charlie died, and I talked about it on the air, actually with a grief counselor, and it helped me, and it helped a lot of other people listening. And I heard about it. It's such a complex kind of transition. It's profound, and it can be transforming, of course. So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no question that it has been extremely transforming for me. You know, I've always been teaching people how to love. It's something I've always been passionate about. It's, mm-hmm. you know, what we do, right? So whether it is mm-hmm. relationally, emotionally, psychologically, or sexually, you know, it's all been about how do we learn how to be in relationships and how to embrace our, you know, our own fears and our own joys, whether it's through our body or our heart or our mind. And death is part of that. You know, mm-hmm. again, it comes in many different forms. Sometimes it's losing, we decide to get married and it's losing a certain amount of independence or, you know, freedom even for that mm-hmm. matter. You know, we make choices and we gain something, again, the beginning of things and also the ending of other things. It happens every day in our life, right? We always have to make some choices and we have beginnings and endings. And at this stage that I'm in now, I mean, it changes every day. Although for me now that it's been 6 months, I'm able to talk about it much, much easier than I was, you know, certainly 3 months ago. Although I have to say the first probably couple of months, maybe even few months, I couldn't even really remember what it felt like to be with him. It was hard for me to even picture him. It was like too much for me to bear. So we kind of go through, again, our own grief and loss however we can. And it's funny how our bodies and our hearts kind of show us the way, and I think we need to honor that. You know, we need to honor our feelings, allow ourselves to feel the grief, and if we're not able to yet, to also honor the numbness. And I certainly had some of that. So the numbness is gone. So that's what's happening.
Right,
now. I'm
right.
at a place where no more numbness, and I allow myself my pain. I have some, you know, good cries, but I'm also very conscious about living my life and moving forward. And so every day, sometimes it's hard to force myself to get up. Sometimes it's difficult to go to the gym or to make a call to a client. But I also know that when I do those things, I'm moving forward, I'm taking care of myself, I'm taking care of other people, and that's what keeps me going. And it does, you know, people say time heals, and I've always said, well, time alone doesn't heal. You know, I certainly know people who have, you know, chosen to stay stuck in grief. And again, we all do the best that we can, but it does take more than time. It does require effort and asking for help. Definitely.
Yes. Talk about that more, because I couldn't agree with you more. And in fact, when we are sad, when we're grieving, it may be a signal to others that we need help, but asking for it if it's not forthcoming. I know I got a lot of support when Charlie died, and I know you, I mean, I saw it at the memorial service, so much support and love for you and for Alan. So, but talk about that a little bit more, your more recent experience of this, and it goes on, onward.
Yeah, we're really fortunate if we have friends who, even when we tell them we want to be alone, that they don't let us. So sometimes yeah. that was the case. You know, I just, for me, and again, we all have different ways, but I just, you know, easily could crawl up in a hole and, you know, not talk to anybody, not see anybody. But I have friends who know me, and they know I do that. So they, I mean, mm-hmm. I had friends sending me groceries, coming over, and they would, you know, they just wouldn't take no for an answer. And while it seemed annoying at times, I definitely appreciated it. And, you know, I have to say, you know, it really was so important to me and healing to know that I had that much love around me. Because, look, it's not easy. People don't know what to say. And that's another thing to say. What do you say to somebody who has had such a loss or who is in such pain? And the truth is, there's nothing. There's nothing you can actually say to take it away. And the best thing to do is just be there. That's all you need to do. Be there. Let them know that you love them. And that is the best thing. I mean, when people would do that, just to show up, you know, whether I wanted them or not, or just even, you know, honestly, just to send me a text and say, hey, I'm thinking about you, or an email, which you did often, so appreciated.
Yeah.
It just means everything. And, you know, I do have, I would say, a majority of my friends actually tend to be therapists. That's
yeah.
just the way it is. And so, you know, they knew. It's like nobody was saying, oh, it's not so bad. You know, it could be worse. You know,
right.
You're fine. You know, nobody said anything like that. I mean, everybody,
yeah.
you know, who knows me for the most part was able just to sit with me, cry with me, you know, let me know that they're there. And that's really the best thing that you can do for people who are grieving. And, yeah.
To really listen, to do the active listening to the person who is grieving. And I think also, I know I appreciated this after Charlie's death, just a friend telling perhaps a fun or humorous story, something that they remembered about
yes.
about Charlie. And so many years ago when I was 14 and my dad was hit by a truck and killed, I can remember even that long ago how much I appreciated, you know, people just telling me stories about my dad, my sweet, beloved daddy. And
yes.
Yeah, didn't you appreciate the stories that people had about Alan?
Yeah, and I think people who are grieving also wonder, and, you know, obviously I'm a psychologist, so I do know some things about grief. I studied it, but studying it and living it are two different things. But so I understood, I know, you know, intellectually, but not necessarily emotionally until now, that it's okay to laugh. It's okay to,
mm-hmm.
you know, to have good moments. And it's also okay to cry and have sad moments. I think the most important thing that's worked for me, and I think for people to understand, whether it's themselves or somebody they love going through, you know, some kind of grief or loss, is really acceptance. Just being okay with wherever you are and definitely telling the stories. I mean, so Alan was British and his family lives in England, and I went to England and spent some time with his sister and her husband and the mother and you know, nieces and nephews. And
yes.
we cried a lot and we laughed a lot. We drank a lot of tea because that's what they do there. It's like, cup of tea. That seems to be the answer for a lot of things. But it was such a healing, wonderful experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so to hear those stories and to be able to look back, and certainly with time that gets easier to when you think of the person who you lost, to be able to think of them and have joy in your heart, you know, rather than the pain of missing them. And, you know, maybe they both come at the same time. I do find I have both at this point. And one of the things that I always talked about, and I actually did live, thank goodness,
yes.
and now I can teach it with just at another level.
With more authenticity.
More authenticity. But when I say now, cherish, you know, every moment. You don't know how long you or the person you love is going to be on this planet or how long you're going to have with them. I've always said that because I've had a lot of loss in my life.
Yeah.
But now it's at a completely different level. And that actually is the way that that we lived. And I don't know why. We just, you know, we were at a point in our life where we were able to live in gratitude. And while we had our conflicts and we annoyed each other like most couples do, we never stayed there for long. And, you know, every day we let each other know through action and words, you know, how appreciative we were and how much we loved one another. And I'm grateful for that, really grateful for that. I don't have to look back and go, oh, I wish I would have. And there are some people who, you know, who may be saying, yeah, I made some mistakes or I have some regrets. We can't change the past, but what we can do is choose today to live fully, to love fully, because that's the best thing we have in our life. You know, the old cliche of when you die, you're not going to think, oh, I wish I would spent more time in the office or had more money in the bank.
Right,
it's always about how fully can you love. And, you know, you learn that when you have loss, but it's something for us, whether you've had a loss or not, to really understand what that is. And when you find yourself bickering over things that are, you know, in hindsight, pretty silly, because really they're not. They're always deeper than what you think they are. Mm-hmm. But they're usually based around fear, right? There's usually something around not feeling loved or not feeling safe. There's something around that, usually under arguments, even if it's the toothpaste cap was left off. You know, that fear, oh, my partner doesn't care about me or they don't listen to me when I tell them to put the toothpaste cap on. We spend a lot of time and energy, you know, in that place of fear. And, you know, it doesn't mean that we don't have conflicts or we avoid talking about difficult things that need to be discussed in relationships. Sometimes we do need to, you know, address something and make a request for something to be different or for our partner to show up in a different way. But ultimately, it's doing it from a place of love. And that's the message, right?
Just that's really the message. I think it's interesting that a number of studies have been made that show that the path of grief is smoother, not necessarily less complicated, but smoother if you don't have regrets, if you don't have, or at least not too many. I mean, I honestly can say I did not have regrets about my marriage with Charlie because we said it all, we did it all, there was a lot of gratitude expressed all the time. And I agree with you. It can also be that I'm even more past 50 than you are, but you're past 50 now, aren't you? You look much younger, of course, but maybe
past
it's
50, yeah.
Yeah. So maybe it's having maturity and maybe having hindsight and perspective and having knowing relationships. And so now I don't just say carpe diem, although I think that's a good thing to say. I declare carpe vitam, which is seize the life, make the most of the life.
Oh, I like that. That's fabulous. I like that a lot. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Yeah. If we keep our eyes open as we go through these various stages and losses, and you've talked about making the most of your next chapter in your life, and I've sort of perceived that way too. I've had quite a few different chapters in my life, and I have learned, and I think I have improved, learn and improve, and take the messages. So it sounds
We never stop. Ideally, we never stop growing. We never stop learning. There's always more there. And, you know, this isn't just about loss. It's about, I mean, we don't know how long we have on this planet. And to live a day, an hour, you know, in fear. Now, we all have fear, obviously. It's about not experiencing fear. It's just not living in fear. And, you know, I think fear is the opposite of love. So when you find yourself in that place, whether you're in a relationship or not, because sometimes the fear stops you from being in a relationship, whether you're in a relationship or not, and, you know, recognizing that, just being aware of what that actually is and doing what you need to do to find that strength to live in love, is it risky? Yes. I mean, when Alan first died, I was thinking to myself, you know, that stupid saying, it's better to have loved and lost than never loved at all, I was thinking, well, that's a bunch of crap, right? This hurt so much. Like, I don't know. I don't know if that's true. But now I do. Of course it's true, because the time that I did have him in my life was incredible, and I am so grateful for that time in those years. It just so happened, for whatever reason, obviously beyond my control, that I was only able to have Alan in my life for 3 years, and in not nearly enough time. But I also can say, man, was I so blessed and fortunate to have him in my life for 3 years. So that's it. I mean, we just don't know. And so to live in a place that is about fear of loss, right? So you don't want to love too fully, because that person may leave, they may cheat on you, they may die. You know, so a lot of us do that. If we've been hurt before, it's hard not to sometimes, you know, to go into that protection mode. And, you know, that's a waste of time. It's, you just want to check yourself and see, is that anything that I am doing? Am I stopping myself from fully loving because I'm afraid that I'm going to lose this love? And again, that's usually not totally conscious, but I do think a lot of people live there.
That's right. I gave you an article on grief, which you said was helpful, the 5 toxic misconceptions about grief. But Dr. Wolfelt, and he has a good, I went to his website, which is centerforloss.com, and he says that it's important to continually remind yourself that leaning toward, not away from the pain, will help you heal. To lean toward the pain when you're feeling bad, then you can stop and allow yourself to feel the emotion by talking to someone or writing about it, but not to run away from the feelings. Lean toward them. Learn from it. It'll help help with the healing, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. You know, I think a lot of us feel so uncomfortable with pain. I mean, look, that's why there's so many antidepressants that are prescribed. Mm-hmm. Not that they don't serve a place. I'm not saying that. There are people who it benefits them greatly. But I also see oftentimes somebody's feeling sad because they had a loss in their life, they're going through divorce, so they go to their general practitioner and get a prescription because they don't want to feel that pain. That's one thing. Another thing that people do is they will avoid pain by going to, well, it could be a number of things. It could be alcohol. It could be drugs. It could be food. It could be sex. It could be computers and TV. It could be, you know, so there's a lot of ways that we can avoid pain. And those things that we do to avoid pain, in other words, we check out, generally it seems like it's working for us because we don't have to experience the pain in the moment, but ultimately it is killing us. It is not helping us move forward, and we will stay in a dark place. So we have to, like you said, or that wonderful gentleman who wrote the article, lean towards the pain, allow ourselves to feel it. It's such an important thing.
Somehow I knew this, I guess because I'm a mental health professional, but at the right after Charlie's death, a physician girlfriend of mine offered me Prozac. And I knew I had situational depression, and I also knew that I wanted to go through all of the stages and feel it and not numb myself out with an antidepressant. So I rejected her offer. And in hindsight, I am so glad, because I was able, and of course, the thing about grief is it doesn't just last, as you already know, for 6 months or a year. You know, I still have reminders of Charlie, and I still think about him. I had a dream about him the other night, which I shared with his sister on the telephone, and Charlie, having been born in Hawaii, and you know, especially when he was younger, he was a surfer. And so in this dream, he was using the surfboard. And he was younger, and he looked so happy, and he was using the surfboard as kind of a paddle board, so he was paddling, but in one hand, he was holding up a cell phone, and he said, I can't reach you with the cell phone, but I can reach you in the dream. I thought that was very profound.
Wow, and who knows, maybe it is a way for him to reach you.
Well, that's right, and he was expressing love, and he had this huge smile on his face. And I know from actually several months after his death, I saw a psychic who was really, really good and channeled Charlie, and one of the first things he said is that I am in a place of so much love and light, and nobody's ever in a bad mood, and that would be important to Charlie. So I felt like it was authentic communication from the other side.
Yeah, well, I've been watching, what's it called, The Hollywood Medium.
Yes, me too.
This young kid, and I find that, for me, just so, I don't know, healing, and it just reinforces that. And I don't know, you know, I'm sure there's people who go, I don't believe in that. But for me, personally, and again, we've got to find what works for us, I just find that it just reinforces my belief, or confirms it, that, we're not done. We're definitely not done. And I do feel that, you know, Alan's love is here with me and protecting me. And, you know, again, it works for me. I say goodnight to him every night. And, you know, there's no right or wrong way to do it. But I think the main thing that you're talking about, which, you know, absolutely people need to think about, is allow yourself to feel the pain so you can move through it. This isn't something you get over. And like you said, it's not something that lasts a certain amount of time and then it's gone. It changes. I mean, it changes all the time. And it's funny because I had a friend, same thing. Like the day after, she's like, oh, you should go on antidepressants. And I said the same thing. I'm like, no.
I need to
experience what I need to experience. Now, it would be different if I wasn't able to function, you know, and if I needed them, again, we all have different needs, and I wasn't able to function, and I felt I really needed it for whatever, you know, then it's certainly something to consider. But I just think that people go to it too quickly. And that's just one way that people escape feeling the pain. Again, there's all of the ways that we try to avoid pain, and it doesn't work. I mean, really, it seems like it works, but we need to really be honest with ourselves. And it's what causes more problems than anything is when we don't allow ourselves to fully grieve. And like you said, mourn, which is what I got from the article you gave me, which is mourning.
Right.
Grieving is feeling the pain, but mourning is expressing it,
exactly.
Talking about it, working through it. And I found that to be extremely helpful. And, you know,
before,
one of the reasons...
Before we move on from the medications business, I wanted to quote Helen Fisher. For the listening audience who don't know about Helen Fisher, she's an anthropologist, a sexologist. She's done some amazing research in the field. And here's what she says. She says that medications can help you sleep. Say you're having a lot of difficulty. They can help you sleep and calm down. They can help you think and act productively in the short term. They can be useful. But she cautions against staying on SSRIs for too long unless they're indicated for, say, another condition such as chronic depression, unless you alter your brain's essential attachment chemistry. You know, she talks about that, potentially impeding your ability to fall in love again. And I think that's such a good point.
Wow, I never thought of it like that. I mean, we know as sex therapists that, you know, SSRIs can certainly not be good for your sex drive or your sex life.
Terrible for it,
Right, but I like what she said. Yeah, we're not talking about people who have chronic depression, who need medication, but again, it's people who they're feeling sadness, situational sadness, as you said, because something in their life is very challenging, and, you know, just wanting to do whatever it takes to avoid that pain. And I promise you, if I believed that there was a pill I could take and I could just be happy and joyful and not experience pain and there'd be no negative consequences, I would be paid lots of money for that pill. And I think a lot of people feel that it does do that, but it doesn't. It doesn't take away the pain, truthfully. You still feel when you're on these antidepressants. And ultimately, again, there's a lot of potential negative consequences for doing that.
I agree with you, absolutely. I just, Helen Fisher, and I believe you also admire her, Most people in our field
do.
Yes. I mean, she, for listening audience who may not know, she used functional MRIs at Rutgers University, looking at people new, their brains of people newly in love and together a long time, but that's for another discussion. But
she's an anthropologist, and she does.
Yes, she is. And so she says she's discovered that thinking about one's beloved activates the same parts of the brain associated with addiction, motivation, and reward. And her work suggests that love itself is addictive and that rejection, so now we've moved on to maybe a divorce, depending upon the circumstances, but many romantic relationships, that rejection prompts a kind of neurochemical withdrawal characterized by heightened anxiety and obsession. So then we get...
Yes, go ahead. That's rough. That's, and some people say, oh, when they're getting divorced, they say it would be easier if he died or she died.
In some ways, that's true.
Right? It's a different kind of pain and loss.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, but go on.
It really is. And, I'll quote another piece of her. She says, it's a wonderful addiction when it's going well. She's meaning love, right? And
yeah.
A perfectly terrible one when it's going poorly. You feel a real intense craving.
So
that's looking at the brain. And I since the decade of the 90s when brain research was greatly facilitated by the functional MRI so we could actually look at the brains, I find the brain explanations a very important piece of our discussions about any of these things.
Well, first of all, yeah, it's fascinating. But you know what else, Diana? It's also talking about what we've said is, and I think this is helpful, when we have that concrete research, that proof that, yeah, it's okay that you feel this way, accept that you feel this way, and understand that that is, for lack of a better word, normal. And I think a lot of us feel like, oh, we're not supposed to feel that much pain. You know, we need to not feel that. And I think accepting that is perfectly human and natural and even beneficial to go through this pain and understand that it's okay to accept that, I think is liberating and, you know, for a lot of people can be healing rather than this idea that, oh, we're not supposed to feel bad, we're not supposed to feel sad and trying to avoid those feelings. And her research just proves that, yeah, this is normal, this is what our brain does, it'll get better, we can do things, but yeah, this is what happens to everybody.
And you've already touched on this, but studies show that we often thrive in the aftermath. There was a 2007 paper published in the Journal of Positive Psychology, and it reported that by 11 weeks after a non-marital breakup, so these would be romantic relationships, committed couples, nearly three-quarters of the respondents felt a sense of personal growth from the split. And that's pretty interesting.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, and pretty quickly when you think about that,
yes,
too.
Yes. Now, yeah. It's going to take so much longer, typically, with the death, and particularly with someone that is very loved, and maybe even somebody with whom there had been a lot of conflict and strife, because then the grief, and we've touched on this already, but just to reiterate, the grief is then made more complicated by the fact that there are regrets. If only I had, I wish we had done, I wished we'd talked it through, you know, all of those kinds of regrets.
Oh, yeah, that's a whole other level, right? What if you had a fight that day and then your partner left and they didn't come home because something happened? Look, that happens all the time. And
it does.
You know,
and we
again,
have to deal with it.
We see
clients with these sorts of issues.
Absolutely, absolutely. And ultimately, it's, you know what, we're all human. We don't do everything perfectly. We make mistakes, and you know, you look at the relationship, not, you don't base the relationship on a moment or a day, but in the whole of the relationship. And everybody has bad days and bad moments, especially in relationships with people that we love, because they trigger us like nothing else, right? Whether it's kids or romantic partners. And again, I just think it's looking at ourselves and other people with a level of understanding and compassion. And sometimes that's hard to do, but it doesn't mean that we stop doing it. You know, it's just acceptance, compassion. And, yeah, we always make mistakes and don't do things perfectly. We always do the best we can. But to work through that, and oftentimes, you know, therapy is the best way to do that. It's just, again, we go back to asking for help. Sometimes it can be through friends, but sometimes that's not enough. Going for professional help can be extremely helpful and beneficial.
Oh, absolutely. I wanted to share a case that I recently had, had broken up with a very beloved person in her life after several years of, he was a fiancé, several years of being together. And so what we worked on is her thinking, and this comes under the heading of cognitive behavioral therapy, right? But I mm-hmm. helped her with her thinking that it was distorted, and that her fiancé's withdrawal was not a result of her failure to be perfect. You know, you get these
right.
people that want to be perfect. And so the technique that I taught her was rooted in this CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. And so it helped her identify and change the beliefs behind the self-defeating thoughts, such as, he's the only man for me, or I'll never fall in love again. And I think, you know, a lot of experts, including you, including me, emphasize the need to redirect obsessive actions and thoughts away from the rejector, away from the rejector.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it'll help the person grow more and move. Haven't you had clients that are so perfectionistic and so their inner critic is so huge?
Oh my God! I mean, the I'm going to say lucky ones or the fortunate ones are the ones who are aware of that, mm-hmm. but many are not, and so that's why therapy. I mean, it's really, how do you get to that place on your own? It's very difficult, if not impossible. So a therapist can kind of open up your mind and show you things that you would not even recognize. So a lot of those automatic thoughts or those obsessive thoughts, we're not even totally conscious of them. And then it runs our life, yeah. And they become our beliefs. And they're, you know, when you look at them, when you can see more clearly, obviously it makes no sense. But we're not always, you know, in our highest functioning brain or self when we are emotionally distraught.
No, exactly. And so I think since we've kind of moved over to something that many of our listeners experience more than the death of a loved one a lot have experienced divorce, but so let's focus in on divorce and then ending a committed relationship. And I have some points, and I'd like to run them past you, and I know you're so articulate and so experienced, and I just love you, Lori. You're such a good friend.
I love you, too.
Thank you.
You are the best. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. So one of the points that can help with healing steps is, I think the first one is to reconnect with yourself and to ask yourself questions like, who am I? And who are my friends? And how should I spend my time? And you're more likely to have a better overall sense of psychological well-being. You know, we start mm-hmm. to feel better when we start to know ourselves again. And it's not the other way around. So reconnecting with yourself. And I'm sure you help a number of your clients do that after a loss.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I like that you're saying, too, is, we do need to ask ourselves some questions and get some clarity. Those are good examples of questions to ask. And, you know, our identities change when we're in a relationship.
we don't always have to lose ourselves in a relationship, but our identities do change a bit. You know, it's a it's a we, and you know, you're a wife or a girlfriend or a partner, and you know, your social life revolves around that. So your identity might change if you are getting divorced. You know, it's a common thing. You know, who wins the friends. That when you do get divorced, you do lose a lot of the friends. You know, it's not that things change. Things definitely change. And to reconnect with yourself and, like you said, and what's important to you. You know, what's the thing that drives you, the sort of the core thing that wants you to get up in the morning? You know, for me, it's making a difference in people's lives. But we have to find out what that is. Maybe it's taking care of your cat. You know, or it could be anything, but it's finding something for you. Usually I think it's around love, though, don't you? But there's lots of love, our self-love, even.
In fact, that was my next point in healing, is to cultivate self-love. And one study showed that it was looking at people coping with divorce, and this psychologist found that people bounce back faster when they are kind and forgiving of what they did or did not do in their marriage and experience some emotion without getting stuck in the anger, sadness, or regret. So this is a way to forgive yourself. You know, sometimes I think self-compassion can be even more important than self-esteem. Although self-esteem, it's a chicken and egg kind of thing, but
well, they're related. But yes, I think it leads to self-esteem, right? If you can be compassionate with yourself, and like you said, if you're stuck in anger, and you're not being accountable for your part in the relationship, and it's just like, well, he or she, they treated me badly, they were this and they were that, and they, you know, and if you're stuck in that place of anger, you're going to have a really difficult time getting through it. So being able to look at things that you learned, right, about yourself that you could do differently or better, it empowers you, because then you have control in your next relationship rather than waiting for the perfect person to come along, knowing that there are things that you can do to change your relationship. It gets you out of that anger. It gets you into compassion, not just for yourself, but also for the other person, and you definitely will heal quicker. But I do agree. My cat's not being very compassionate. Hey!
Sorry. Is that your cat?
Yeah. Stop it.
Does your cat want attention?
All he wants to do is hump her, and she just is not interested sometimes. So I'm sure some of the listeners can relate. they might feel like doing that sometimes. But yeah, that's what happens.
Well, while we're talking about self-compassion, I think that it's important to treat yourself the same way you would treat a treasured friend. And so, you know, some people really do think that they need self-criticism to motivate themselves. And there is growing research that confirms that self-criticism is a poor success strategy. And rather than it being motivating, it makes people feel anxious and incompetent and depressed. You know,
I agree.
And a lot of these people who have a very strong inner critic had an actual critical parent, maybe even two of them.
Probably, yes. Yes. Yeah,
so their parents' ego state is very strong, the critical parent.
And their intention was good, because that's what the parent was taught. Well, if I tell them what they're doing wrong and I criticize them, it's going to push them to do better. But you're right, I don't think it works. And I was going to say, remember when there was like advice, if you wanted to lose weight, you would find a fat picture of yourself and put it on the refrigerator?
Yeah.
So that's how to motivate you? Yeah, but actually, the better way is to put a thin picture of you, a picture where you feel good and you feel confident. To put that picture on the refrigerator, if you're going to put a picture at all, that would be much more motivating.
Much
right?
more
so
motivating.
You feel good.
I'm glad you made that point. Yes, I think another way to build self-compassion is to say soothing words to yourself when you're upset. You know, you have an inner dialogue. It would be the same kind of language you might use to comfort a friend in need. So you might say to yourself, talking to yourself, right? I know you're feeling mm-hmm. bad right now, and I really want you to be happy. I'm here to support you in any way I can. Those are soothing words that you're saying to yourself.
Right, as opposed to the other things. And I love the way that you put that, to talk to yourself as if you were talking to somebody that you really loved, a friend. And, mm-hmm. you know, we're much more critical and difficult and hard on ourselves than we would ever be with somebody who we love. And in fact, we do want to love ourselves and treat ourselves lovingly. So I love that. That's great. That's great advice, especially when we feel like we've been rejected, right? We feel like our partner decided they didn't want to be with us anymore. They cheated on us. They decided, you know, they were moving on. I mean, that's a painful thing, and it's not uncommon and certainly is understandable why the first place we go is what's wrong with me. And, there's nothing wrong with you. There was something wrong for that person. It's true that maybe there were some things in the relationship that weren't working out, and maybe you could grow from that, but it's never about anything that's wrong with you.
Yes, and, you know, I use attachment theory in my practice a fair amount. Do you, Lori?
I don't. I'm aware of it. Sometimes we'll talk about it briefly.
Right.
I do think it's important. It's just not the area that I work in. I'm more about differentiation, if we're going to make a distinction.
Yes.
But I do think it's all important. You know, it depends on what's happening, but it definitely has an impact on our lives, our attachment style, for sure. How do you use it, and what do you find works
well,
for you?
Well, you know, if we're talking about relationships ending, I think if we look at attachment theory, we can see how our earliest experiences with parents and other caregivers influence how we respond to breakups. So if caretakers were available and responsive when we needed them, and this would be, we're looking mostly at when we're really little, early child, infancy, early childhood.
Really little, yeah.
Yeah. If we had secure attachment, and I was lucky, I had that, and I know how lucky I am, but secure attachment, then we do better in our interpersonal relationships as adults. Because we feel worthy of love, and our partners serve as a secure base in our lives, and the end of a relationship doesn't gravely affect our fundamental sense of ourselves. Now, conversely, insecure attachment, where early caretakers are not consistently available when needed, for example. So, and sometimes, you know, I had secure attachment, but it was severed because of my father's death when I was 14. It was severed somewhat, but at least I had a good beginning. But anyway, adults with anxious attachment style tend toward needier behavior in intimate relationships. And so they'll have, perhaps with a breakup, they'll have more anxiety, and this can be associated then with preoccupation with an ex, and the loss of a relationship might have more physical and emotional distress, and maybe even more dramatic efforts to restore the relationship, and maybe even angry and vengeful behavior. Now, this gets into at the other end of the continuum with a breakup, even when you've been rejected. Not you, not me. When a person has been rejected,
although I think I have been.
What?
Yes. Although I think I have been in my life rejected. I hate to admit it, but it's probably happened. But you know what you're saying, Diana, that is, I love, because, you know, like, you're, whether it's attachment or differentiation or self-love, they're all so connected, because our attachment style, what that does is it really does affect our differentiation. Means that we can stay strong, that we can stay whole in a place of love, regardless of what's going on around us, regardless of what our partner is thinking or doing. Basically, it doesn't take us down. And so if we have a strong attachment style, we have more differentiation. And the point that you were making before, which is why I love just sort of tying it all up, but I think it's really great that, and I never thought of it this way, that when we can truly love ourselves and, you know, hold our self-esteem at a healthy place, you know, knowing that we are no worse and also no better than anyone else, and loving ourselves, treating ourselves lovingly, which gives us the message that we're lovable, that also will teach us, and I think it's Dan Siegel that says this, that we can learn new attachment styles, or he says we can earn it, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
because we had, you know, we'll say neglectful parents, or we have an anxious attachment style or avoidance,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't mean that that's our life legacy, because God knows I didn't have a healthy one, right? So
yeah.
we can learn and earn by loving ourselves, by learning how to do things differently, talk to ourselves differently, even like you said, to have a healthy attachment and a loving relationship. It takes some work, but it is doable, and I think that's a good message.
You know, our colleague Stella Resnick talks about this in her book, The Pleasure Zone, which I refer to many clients, mm. which, of course, is not about just sexual pleasure. It's about intellectual pleasure, spiritual pleasure, and so on. But she came out of a family where her stepfather beat her regularly, and her mother was emotionally distanced, didn't protect her. And so she had anxious attachment, and she went through all kinds of learning experiences in her life. And then finally, at some time over 30, she met Alan, who has been her... Oh, another Alan, yes.
Yes.
Has been her husband for 35 years, and he came out of secure attachment. So she talks about how she has earned secure attachment by being with Alan all these years. And so, what Dan Siegel said is true.
Yeah, you can't earn it. And I'm going to say that my relationship with my Alan, even though I was older, obviously, than 35, and it was only for 3 years, grew immensely.
Yeah.
Immensely. I thought I knew how to be in a relationship. I'd been certainly helping people do it for many years, but I just grew leaps and bounds by actually living it, and he helped. So he pushed me to that, which is another reason why I am at another level of passion about doing this work. I feel that it's something that would be important for him, for me to do, and
yes.
I want to make it worthwhile, you know, our relationship, and I do feel I'm better equipped to help people on a different level than I was before. So, you know, through our endings and our pain, if we move through it, or when we move through it, there are new beginnings, and there is growth, and, you know, I know that's hard to hear sometimes. If you're in it, it doesn't necessarily make you feel better, but it is important to know that it is possible, and you just have to realize that, have faith in that process, move through it, and there is something around the corner that you don't know yet, and it's a new beginning.
A new beginning. That's we're coming to the end of the program, and I think that's such a nice, upbeat kind of thought, that we can have new beginnings and lots of growth. I know that I'm, and I believe, you know, it's going to be, I'm taking my crystal ball, Lori.
Okay, but I want to hear what it says.
Well, it says that eventually, my crystal ball says it'll be about a year, but you're going to be in another really healthy, happy, sexy relationship. And because you have transformed yourself through this, it took me 10 years. I mean, I had a couple of relationships after Charlie died, but 10 years of living and observing and growing, and before I met Brian, and that was just next month, it'll be 6 years ago. And I wouldn't have...
He was worth waiting for.
He really was. I mean, I wouldn't have the healthy, happy, sexy relationship I have with him if I hadn't experienced all this growth. So that's my prediction for you, because you have so much to offer a good man. But I think you're grieving, you're mourning. It'll take a little more time. And then you may want to start dating again. And in the current psychology today, let's see, it is current. Yeah, it's September, October. No, it's last year. I saved them.
Not current at all, as a matter of fact, but still relevant. Yeah,
yeah, it's so this widower wrote in, and his wife had died just 10 months ago, and he'd been dating a woman, and he had all kinds of questions, and so she answers, this is Hara Estroff Morano, the better question might be, how fast? Being with someone fun is great, especially after a spouse's death, and you're lucky to have found that, but perhaps you are rushing the demand for affection in walking on eggshells, working too hard to get it, hurrying to get back to the woodwork of love leaves no place for the dust to settle, rather poetically stated, I think.
I think she said that well. Yeah, and the way I look at it is, with anything, whether you're choosing who to be with, what decisions to make, do you want to leave this person? I mean, whenever you're making a decision, to recognize, is it coming from a place of fear, or is it coming from a place of strength, which is also love? And so in this case, for this man, while it seemed like a good idea, perhaps he wasn't able to go to that place of love yet.
Lori, the music signals the end of the program.
I don't want to say goodbye, Diana. It's been so lovely talking to you.
Thank you, and you as well. The program will be archived. I know you'll want to send your clients to it, and others, and me too. So,
thank you so much, Diana. It's been a pleasure. I love you, and we will talk soon. And thank you, everybody, for listening.
Yeah, thanks, everybody, for listening. And again, thank you, Lori. Bye-bye. Happy feet, do-da-da, happy feet, do-da-da.